Greetings and welcome to Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. And in this episode of Word Magazine, I'm going to be reading a short excerpt from a book by Matthew Barrett that's titled Simply Trinity. And I'm going to be looking at what he says in this book related to what he sees as a failure in modern translations to deal appropriately with references to the only begotten Son in the Gospel of John, in places like John 1:14, John 1:18, John 3:16. And at any rate, this book has gotten a lot of attention recently. It was named by Christianity Today. It's one of its books of the year in the category of theology and ethics. And they announced this at the end of December of last year, and they call it their 2022 Book Awards. So I did a podcast sort of related to this topic last year in June in Word Magazine number 207 that was titled, Is the Modern Text of John 1:18 Out of Sync with the Nicene Creed? And in that episode, I was looking at a podcast interview that Matthew Barrett did with Charles Lee Irons on this very topic, the proper translation of John 1:18. And at the time, I had not dipped into Barrett's book, but I had not really read it. And since then, I have been able to work through the book. And I just thought it might be interesting to follow up and just look at a couple of pages out of Matthew Barrett's book, particularly since it's getting a lot of attention right now, you know, having been named Christianity Today Book of the Year in the category of theology and ethics. And it's really interesting because here is a systematic theologian, and he's dealing with a problem with the way modern texts and modern translations have altered a passage in Scripture that has had wider theological, Christological ramifications than perhaps the text critics and translators were aware of when they altered the text. So let me just say a couple words about the book Simply Trinity. I might at some point write a review and maybe do a podcast on the book in general, as opposed to what we're doing today, which is just a look in at one particular part of it. It is an interesting book. It's touted as being, you know, kind of presented as a popular level treatment of the doctrine of the Trinity. It's not necessarily, though, the easiest read. It's actually quite challenging. It really makes you think about the doctrine of the Trinity. And essentially what Matthew Barrett is doing in this book is defending what we might call a classical Christian view of the Trinity. He argues that there's been a degree of what he calls Trinity drift. And he argues in particular for the doctrine of the simplicity of God. He argues for the retrieval of the sort of classic doctrine of the eternal generation of the Son. He talks in terms of, you know, the Father is unbegotten, the Son is eternally begotten, and the Spirit is spirated. And so he wants a retrieval of this sort of classical language. It also ties into some, you know, controversies going on right now in some Reformed circles, as he's arguing for the use of the language and terms and descriptions of Thomas Aquinas. And some people are arguing against the appropriateness of using the language of Aquinas. But anyways, it's an interesting book. But like I said, my interest is more in these couple of pages where he addresses this issue related to translation. I don't really have notes for this Word Magazine podcast. You can probably tell that by now. I'm doing it more extempore And so, but I will put a post on my blog at jeffriddle.net where I will have a link to the previous podcast, Word Magazine 207, and I'll have a link to the Christianity Today 2022 Book Awards. You can read what they said about the Matthew Barrett book. And actually, I did a Word Magazine podcast way back in 2016 on John 1:18. It was more of a text note where I was dealing with the external, internal evidence, and I wasn't dealing with the sort of theological ramifications of John 1:18. But at any rate, let's go ahead and turn and look at the book. And I'm looking at pages 185 to 190. So the heading for this is, and it's in the chapter, it's within the chapter that is titled, Is Eternal Generation Central to the Gospel? It's chapter 7. And again, he's challenging this Trinity drift that modern evangelicals have departed from classical Trinitarian theology, in that they no longer affirm the doctrine of the eternal generation of the Son. He has a pretty caustic, pretty direct chapter later within the book. The very next chapter, chapter 8, where he really critiques the popular modern idea of the eternal functional subordination of the Son to the Father, so-called EFS. And he really goes after Bruce Ware of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and essentially accuses Ware and Grudem of falling into pretty gross error in the way that they have advocated a view of the relationship between the Father and the Son as not being appropriate, actually being dangerous, and presenting a subordinationist version of a subordinationist view of the doctrine of Christ. Argues that it's on the line between presenting a view of tritheism or Sabellianism, modalism. So he really is defending the classical doctrine of the eternal generation. And it's in the midst of this chapter 7 on that he sort of calls out problems in modern translations. So the heading for this little section I'm going to do a readout of is Lost in Translation, the Only Begotten Son. So it begins, one reason Bible reading Christians today find this language of begotten so foreign and strange is because they, unlike all English readers of the Bible before them, have been fed new translations of the Bible that have removed the word begotten from the Gospel of John. No, I'm not a stubborn skeptic, always grumbling that they don't make translations like they used to. I am, for the most part, happy with many contemporary translations of the Bible. As a pastor and a professor, I use contemporary translations such as the ESV and NIV when preaching and lecturing. So anyways, he starts off, and I'll try to differentiate between what he's reading and my commentary on it. That's the first paragraph. So he starts off saying, part of the reason why people have modern evangelicals have lost touch with the classical doctrine of the eternal generation of the Son is that the classical phraseology of the Son having been begotten of the Father has been removed in many modern translations. Now, he has to give a mea culpa and say, now, I'm not, what does he call it, a stubborn skeptic grumbling about new translations. He doesn't want to be accused of being a KJV-onlyist. You don't want to do that. He has to say, give everybody, the reader, his bona fides. I use the ESV, I use the NIV. It's just this one exceptional place where I think that those modern translations have gone off the rails. So, this is where he begins, and although he might not be as critical in his assessment, it is, I think, noteworthy that he is raising questions about the wisdom of some of what's happened with some modern translations. So here's the next paragraph. Now we're on page 186. However, when it comes to the Gospel of John, a misstep has been made, and it is no small one. Its theological consequences are serious. As I shared at the start of this book, when I was a young, eager student and was taught the doctrine of the Trinity by evangelical teachers at evangelical institutions, never had I ever heard a word about eternal generation. When it was mentioned, they swore it was nowhere in the Bible. But here's the problem. All the Bible translations I was given to read and memorize, the NIV, the ESV, the RSV, the HCSB, that's the Holman Christian Standard Bible, etc., excised only begotten from John's gospel, as well as from his first epistle. For over four centuries, those who translated the New Testament from Greek to English translated the word monogenes as only begotten. For example, consider that famous passage, John 3:16, which reads in the King James Version, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life." John says something similar in his first epistle. This is from 1 John 4:9, and here he uses the KJV. "In this was manifested the love of God toward us, because that God sent his only begotten Son into the world that we might live through him." Only begotten language is found throughout John's writings. For example, John 1:14, John 1:18, John 3:18. So at the end of this paragraph, let me pause for a moment. So he's pointing out a problem. That is, when you look at the Gospel of John, there are some five places where in Greek, the term monogenes, and often tandem with the word son, monogenes huios, appear. John 1:14, John 1:18, John 3:16, John 3:18, and 1 John 4:9. So five places in the Johannine corpus, four in the Gospel of John, one in the first epistle of John. And the problem is, in those modern translations that he lists, they no longer render the term monogenes as only begotten, or monogenes huios as the only begotten Son. And so here's the next paragraph. Barrett continues. However, in the 20th century, scholars erased only begotten from John's corpus and replaced this phrase with the word only or unique instead. Starting with the Revised Standard Version, translators followed suit. God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, or his unique Son. Whether it was always intentional or not, generations of Christians were never introduced to the concept of eternal generation, nor could they see why the concept was so ingrained in Scripture's presentation of the Son of God, not even in a gospel like John's. And as we saw at the start of this book, even theologians like Wayne Grudem used to jump on board, concluding from new translations of the Bible, that eternal generation was not a biblical concept, but one imposed on the text. So let me pause here. Let me just point something out. I appreciate what Barrett is doing, what he's saying. What I would just add, and I talk about this more extensively in Word Magazine 207 and also in Word Magazine 56, is that the issue in places like John 1:18 in particular is not only the fact that the term monogenes is no longer translated only begotten, and instead it's translated as only or unique. That's a translational issue. And in fact, the issue is, and Charles Lee Irons talks a lot about this in an article that he has in the book that's called Retrieving Eternal Generation. He's got a chapter called The Lexical Defense of the Johannine Only Begotten. And he makes the point that the term monogenēs traditionally was thought to have its origins in the Greek verb genao, which means to beget. Beginning really in the mid-20th century, some scholars came along and said, no. The etymology of monogenēs is not in the verb genao, to beget, but it's instead in the verb genomai, which means to be or to become. And so monogenēs would rather be rendered as only or unique or special. And so this, beginning with the RSV translation, 1946-1952, the rendering of monogenēs changed. The other thing, though, that happened was there's also a textual issue. That's a translation issue. There was a textual issue in places like John 1:18, whereas in the traditional text, it reads monogenēs huios, the only begotten son. The modern text decided to replace huios with the word theos, God. So it read monogenēs theos. And you might say, well, that's high Christology. That's calling Jesus the one and only God. But as many scholars since then have pointed out who hold to classical theism, that might have been the result of texts that were trying to undermine the doctrine of the eternal generation of the Son. And the title huios is a very important title for Christ. He is the Son of God. He's the only begotten Son of God. And so there's a translational issue. Should monogenēs read only begotten, or should it read only or unique? And there's a textual issue. Should it be the monogenēs huios, the only begotten Son, or should it be monogenēs theos, the only God? So Barrett seems mainly to address the translational issue, not really the textual issue, but at least we can be thankful that he's addressing that. Now, let's continue. Next paragraph, this is page 187. Barrett continues, however, that consensus is now changing, and fast. In recent years, biblical scholars are now conceding that English translators for the past 400 years were onto something when they translated monogenēs as only begotten. And not just Bible scholars since the Reformation, but all the church fathers who believed the word conveyed the biological metaphor of begetting. For example, Charles Lee Irons warns against two extremes. Those who force monogenēs to mean only begotten in every possible New Testament verse text versus those who deny that monogenēs can ever mean only begotten in any New Testament texts. The truth is somewhere in between. When the context is right, monogenēs does mean only begotten. Irons surveys biblical and ancient literature and concludes that the earliest meaning of monogenēs was biological, in reference to an only child. Years later on, other uses occurred as well, metaphorical and scientific. However, and he quotes here from Irons, quote, the fundamental biological concept of begetting is surely present in the word when used in literal or metaphorical familial context, end quote. So let's continue. This is still Barrett. He continues, that last word context is key. We don't decide what meaning a word takes on by looking it up in a dictionary and flipping a coin to determine which definition we should use. For instance, the word light can refer to something that is radiant and bright, like light from the sun, daylight, or it can refer to something that is not very heavy, like a newborn baby or a purse with nothing inside. How do we know which meaning to use? Context. How the word is used in a sentence or a paragraph. Likewise, with monogenēs, the word may have different definitions, but its earliest history shows that the word was used to refer to something biological, something familial. And when we open the ancient scriptures, the biblical authors use the word in a similar biological manner, referring to the filial relationship between the father and the son. So he's just making the point that, yes, you have to look at how monogenēs is used in context, But in the context of the New Testament, in these five uses in the Johannine passages, the context is biological. It's using the metaphor of the biological begetting of a father of a son to describe the spiritual relationship, we might say, between the Father and the Son within the Trinity. He continues, consider John, for example. In the five times monogenes appears, John 1:14, 1:18, John 3:16, John 3:18, and in 1 John 4:9, its context is familial and filial every single time. In other words, the context assumes a biological metaphor is applied to God. He is called Father, and his offspring is called Son. Of course, the language is analogical, not literal. There is no mother. Nevertheless, it is familial at its core. And he continues, ask yourself, how does does John begin his gospel? Yes, the context of the latter half of John 1 is the incarnation. But in order to understand the incarnation, John takes us back to the beginning. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And he quotes John 1:1 using the King James Version. John intends his readers to know from the start that Jesus' divine existence didn't begin like every other man's existence. In fact, it never began. He is pre-existent. His past is unlike our past without a genesis, and is to be traced back to God himself in eternity. Never was there a time when God the Father was without his Word, John 1:1. And as John will soon reveal, his Word is none other than God's Son. And so he's making the point that John describes Jesus as the Son of God, but he is the eternally existing Son of God. And the revealed way of describing the relationship between the Father and the Son is one of the Father begetting the Son. No, it's not a literal biological begetting, but it is analogical language. It's unlike the relationship between a human father and a human son, because that is punctiliar. It has a particular starting point. But with respect to the Father and the Son, they have an eternal relationship of origins, where the unbegotten Father is from eternity begetting the Son. And so this is the whole doctrine of the eternal generation of the Son. He continues. Now we're on page 188. We know the context is filial and sonship is in view, because in 1:14 and 1:18, John refers both to God and Father, treating the two as synonyms. The backstory of the incarnation is biological, analogically speaking. The eternal origin of the Word is none other than God the Father. Yet, unlike human sons, the Word, or Son, has no point of generation. He is begotten from eternity, for not only was the Word with God, the Word was God. He continues, when John turns to the miracle of the incarnation, he presupposes eternal sonship. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we behold his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Again, he's quoting John 1:14, and it's interesting because Matthew Barrett is, in throughout this little segment I'm reading, he uses the King James Version. Why? Because it's a text that it's a translation that's based on the traditional text, and it was created by translators who were theologians, churchmen, and they understood the theology of the eternal generation of the Son. And it's appropriately reflected in the translation that they make, unlike many modern translators who are not the theological equals of some of the great men of the past. And I'm talking about both the men who affirmed and acknowledged the received text of the Greek New Testament, and also those who translated into the vernacular languages of Europe, not only in English, in translations like Tyndale's translation or the Geneva Bible or the King James Version, but also in the other classic Protestant translations of Europe. He continues, page 188, when John turns to the miracle of the incarnation, I already read this part, I'll pick it up here. Glory, reflects his familial origin. From the Father, he is the glory of God, because he is none other than God, than the Son of God, the very image and likeness of his Father. Begetting, therefore, must be in view. The concept that the Son bears the Father's family likeness or image and reveals who the Father is further reinforces the biological metaphor of begetting. In all our efforts to translate monogenes as only instead of only begotten, we have failed to finish John's sentence. The word's glory is the glory as of the only begotten of the Father. Have we forgotten already where the Father came from and what his eternal origin then implies for his Son, the Word, the one in whom such glory radiates? If we have forgotten, perhaps verse 18 will jog our memory. No man hath seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him. Again, citing John 1:18 from the KJV. Or, as the verse reads in the New American Standard Bible, no one has seen God at any time. The only begotten God, who is in the bosom of the Father, he has explained him. And again, this is a place where I think I would disagree with Barrett, because he thinks that the key issue is merely how monogenes is translated. So it's okay for him if it reads monogenes huios, the only begotten Son, or it could be, as it is in the New American Standard Bible, monogenes theos, the only begotten God. But both of those things actually undermine the doctrine of eternal generation. Rendering monogenes as only or unique undermines eternal generation. Accepting the modern critical text, which reads theos rather than huios, also explicitly undermines the doctrine of the eternal generation of the Son. Let me pick it up again. Notice the context once more. The monogenes is located where? In the bosom of the Father. The reason John can say the Word was sent by the Father to become flesh and dwell among us is because the Word is none other than the Son, whose origin is from the Father. Begotten by the Father in eternity, the Son can be sent by the Father to become incarnate in history. We just got a couple more paragraphs to read, and they're shorter. Let's continue. This is now page 189 of Barrett's book, Simply Trinity. That explains why he alone, as the Word, can reveal the Father. God, as God, is hidden from our finite gaze. But if he who is begotten, who is in the very bosom of the Father, becomes flesh and dwells among us, then this God is made known to us. As John moves back and forth between eternity and incarnation, the context in which he does so is filial. Irons, talking about Charles Lee Irons, says, quote, thus John 1:14 and 18 are of crucial importance for demonstrating that the Johannine monogenes cannot be reduced to only of his kind, but must have a metaphorical, biological meaning, only begotten. John views Christ as the only begotten Son of God in the sense that he is the Father's only proper offspring deriving his divine being from the Father. And now here's his conclusion. In sum, there is a lesson here. Sonship and begetting go hand in hand. They define each other. To put forward monogenes as if it means only and has nothing to do with Jesus' pre-existent eternal Trinitarian origin from the Father is to rob the word of its meaning and treat the context of John 1 out of context altogether. However, the doctrine of eternal generation does not merely depend on whether monogenes is translated as only begotten. That assumption has led translators and theologians to abandon that doctrine, but the concept is far more ingrained within the scriptural presentation of the Son to depend on one word. It is not only rooted in the meaning of the divine name itself, Son, as we've seen, but embedded within a diverse mosaic of scriptural imagery. Here he seems to be in this last paragraph saying, okay, even if you don't buy my arguments about John 1:18 and the importance of rendering monogenes as only begotten, there are lots of other passages in the New Testament that are proof texts for the doctrine of the eternal generation of the Son. But, you know, he can make that argument if he wants. I think he is fine to just stand his ground and say it's important that John 1:18 and the other passages within John where the term monogenes appears, that it be translated properly, and in the case of John 1:18, that the traditional text would be affirmed. Well, we worked through the handful of pages there from Barrett's book, Simply Trinity. And I guess the point really to come through here at the end is just that when you abandon the traditional text and translations made from the traditional text, what you end up doing is opening really a Pandora's box of problems. And that is the modern text and translations based on it often depart from classical theological articulations of the faith. That's one of the great things about the traditional text, and we might call it the traditional Protestant translations of that text. And that is that the scholars and the translators were schooled in, aware of, what we might call the great tradition of Orthodox Christianity, including classical theism. And they were affirming a text that affirmed that great tradition. What we have now are modern scholars, many of whom are in the academy, many of whom are not professed believers. And even those who are professed believers often might know a lot about the nuts and bolts of the study of ancient manuscripts, but they're not schooled in systematic theology. They're not schooled in Christology. And so they tinker with the text, and then there are these unintended consequences. Matthew Barrett is sounding alarm, and he's saying, we've got a problem with Trinity drift among evangelicals. And part of the root of that problem is in modern translations. Now, I wish he had gone a little further and said, not just with translations, but with also modern texts. And I think that's certainly the case with respect to John 1:18. Well, I thank you for listening to this episode of Word Magazine. I hope that you've been able to follow these sort of extempore ramblings that I have given today in this episode, and you can find some things that are helpful in this discussion. Like I said, I won't be posting any notes because I don't have any, but I will put up a couple links to the past Word Magazine episodes if you want to go back and look at Word Magazine 56, Word Magazine 207, and I'll put that link to Barrett's book being announced one of Christianity Today's 2022 Books of the Year in the category of theology and ethics. I hope that you've enjoyed this episode of Word Magazine. I'll look forward to speaking to you in the next episode. Till then, take care and God bless.